Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
It used to be seen as a costly and risky challenge, but sustainability has now become a business imperative.
Not having the data is no longer an excuse.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our second episode is all about moving from intention to action on sustainability. Episode 2 of Resilient Edge is coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to the programme. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. This hour we're going to be asking if and how Hezbollah can come back from the extensive attacks on its personnel and communication devices widely attributed to Israel. That's our main story today. Also on the programme, how do you fit 3 billion codes that make up our human genome on what's called a 5D memory crystal?
At a high level, it's a very stable quartz, and the 5D, as I understand it, comes from the fact that they're able to encode things sort of in two orthogonal layers or dimensions that can be read out when light is shone kind of in two different directions.
But first, the Israeli military says its warplanes have tonight been striking Hezbollah sites in southern Lebanon, hitting around 30 targets, including a weapons dump. That follows a series of coordinated explosions in Lebanon over 2 days, which killed 37 people and injured thousands. Funerals continue to be held for those killed when pagers and later walkie-talkies exploded without warning. Israel has not admitted responsibility for those attacks, but has announced a new phase in its conflict with Lebanon. Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, whose military and political members were the primary targets of the earlier explosions, today called what had happened a declaration of war, and he warned of serious consequences.
There is no doubt that the aggression that took place is a major one, and as I said in my speech, it is unprecedented and will be met with tough retribution and just punishment, where they expect it and where they do not.
The last time there was a full-scale war between Israel and Hezbollah, with Israeli troops operating on the ground in southern Lebanon, was back in 2006. The Israeli Prime Minister at the time was Ehud Olmert. What did he expect to happen now?
I have no expectation. I hope that all of the players, all of the participants, all of the decision-makers will cool down a little bit. Something happened the last couple of days. As you know, the Israeli government didn't assume responsibility for it. But regardless of whether it was done by Israel or not, the Hezbollah believed that Israel did it, and they also charged Israel for this. So therefore, there is now an expectation about what should be the reaction.
I asked our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, what he'd made of the televised speech this afternoon of the Hezbollah leader.
It was always going to be a lot of fiery, angry rhetoric and promises of retaliation in some form. I think the only clue possibly was him saying you may not necessarily hear about it in advance. And he paid tribute to the first aid workers who had rushed to help and commiserated with those who'd been killed and injured in all of this. But I don't think there were any great surprises, because he knows and Israel knows that both sides know that there are constraining factors here stopping both sides going into a full-scale conflict. For Hezbollah, they know that Israel has the superior firepower. But in that sense, he did actually say, if you want to come and invade us here in Lebanon, bring it on. Because that would be luring Israel onto the ground of Hezbollah's choosing. And the last time that happened in 2006, during the short 1 month-long Hezbollah-Israel war, the Israeli army got a bloody nose. Neither side emerged from that victorious. It ended in a stalemate. But Israel's tanks got blown up, they got ambushed and attacked from the side with quite sophisticated Russian-made anti-tank guided missiles, and Hezbollah's got a formidable arsenal that would rain down missiles on Israel. So that's a deterrent there. You've also got the US, Antony Blinken, in the region, trying to urge calm on all sides. The problem here is that it's partly a matter of pride. Hezbollah has been utterly humiliated and embarrassed and humbled by this. But Iran also is feeling that it has a score to settle with Israel because of the July the 31st assassination in Tehran of Ismail Haniyeh, the leader of the political wing of Hamas, which was, again, hugely embarrassing for Iran. And Iran still hasn't settled that score. So the one thing that could take a lot of the heat out of all of this is if there is a ceasefire deal for Gaza. That's the one thing the Americans, together with the Qataris and Egyptians, are really pushing for.
The Hezbollah leader was in no doubt that the Israelis were behind the explosions of electronic personal devices. Is anyone in any doubt?
There is no doubt whatsoever that Israel was behind this. There is no other state or organization in the region or elsewhere that has both the intent and the technical capability to do this. So Israel may never own up to this, but this is the work of Mossad. This is what it does. There is form here. Shin Bet, the domestic Israeli political, the Israeli domestic intelligence agency, did, and this is confirmed, it's open, they assassinated somebody called Yahya Ayash, who was a Hamas bomb maker, in January 1996. And they did that by sabotaging his mobile phone, which blew up, killing him. So there's form here.
In the short term, though, is Hezbollah in a practical situation to be able to launch an immediate retaliation, given that these were highly targeted attacks?
It's certainly not in a position to fight a war. It's reeling from this, and its entire command and control structure, which Hassan Nasrallah boasted that it was intact. Of course it's not. It's absolutely in pieces. You know, they're practically back to flying pigeons. It's a mess, because this makes it very difficult for the leadership in South Beirut, in a place called Dahia, to be able to communicate to the units on the ground, spread out in southern Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley, and to some extent in Syria. So they are compromised there. But they are a resilient organization that train intensively with help from the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps. They are innovative. They're imaginative. I'm not saying these words in any way to praise them. They are a prescribed terrorist organization by many governments, but they are a force to be reckoned with. And seasoned Israeli IDF, Israel Defense Forces commanders, know that, and that a war with them is not something that they will undertake lightly.
Frank Gardner reporting. One of the questions being posed now is what purpose the exploding devices might have served Israel tactically. Could they be a prelude to a wider military campaign? We asked the Israeli government and the Israeli Defense Forces for an interview. They haven't provided anyone for us to speak to today. I have been talking to Eitan Shamir, who is formerly of the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs. He's now head of the Begin Sadat Center at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Should we assume, I asked him, that Israel was responsible?
We can assume it was an Israeli operation. So the big question to me is the timing. Why now? I can think of three different possibilities. One, that it was a situation of use it or lose it, meaning there was a risk of being exposed and they had to make a decision very quickly whether to use it or not to get the benefit of doing a very serious damage to Hezbollah. Another possibility is to send a very strong message to Hezbollah that it is vulnerable and Israel is able to penetrate Hezbollah. The third option, that this is a first salvo for a larger campaign that Israel is planning to carry out.
Critics, including the United Nations, say what happened broke international law. But did it achieve things strategically, in your opinion?
I don't know about international law. I'm not an international law expert, but definitely this was an operation that was specifically designed to target Hezbollah's operators who were carrying these pagers. Now, of course, there is always a risk of some collateral damage. Whether it has a strategic value, I think it does. Whether it's going to affect the whole war that is being waged and this conflict with Hezbollah and other Iranian proxies, that we'll have to see.
Well, it was a clear provocation. Was that useful?
What do you mean it was a clear provocation? For the last year, Hezbollah is shooting freely almost every day around 50 to 70 rockets and a number of attack drones, explosive drones, not to mention anti-tank missiles that they fire from a few kilometers. There are 70,000 Israelis who have been evacuated from their homes. The whole area is in ruins. So it's clear that Hezbollah is the aggressor, and Israel has every right to respond to that.
But Israel will also expect a response to this, won't it?
Well, Hezbollah is an arch enemy of Israel. And of course, the two sides, are going to do their best in order to have gains over the other side. This is what war is all about.
The Israeli military did announce plans to continue its war in the north, and there were strikes in the north. Could it be the start of a bigger operation, do you think?
That's what I said, that this operation could be an opening salvo for a bigger operation. However, there are many considerations on the Israeli side why not to go ahead and do it. The military is still fighting in Gaza. There is a question whether both in terms of material and manpower, Israel is ready for such a big offensive. And of course, there is the American factor, because for such a war, Israel does need the support of the Americans. That the Americans are, to say as an understatement, they are not enthusiastic about a further escalation with Hezbollah.
The defense minister seemed quite clear yesterday when he announced a new phase of the war, that they were moving resources north and that they could fight a war on two fronts. That was the implication.
I think Israel has enough troops to divert its attention from Gaza to Lebanon. The size that is needed to do the mopping up operations in Lebanon are not very large. However, the question is the need for mainly the reservists who are making up the bulk of the Israeli ground forces to recuperate. Because these people have left their homes and went to the military for a very long period of time. They're exhausted. And this is one aspect. The other aspect is the munitions and the spare parts and the whole logistical tail that you need for such a war. And therefore, the question is, what is the situation with the Israeli stockpiles? Now, we don't know exactly the numbers. Of course, this is highly confidential. But absolutely, we can assume that there are some gaps that the Israeli army would like to fill in order to be able to launch a big campaign against Hezbollah.
What did you personally make of what the Hezbollah leader said today?
So first of all, I think it was which was an indication of the seriousness of the Israeli attack. He was much more, I would say, humble than previous speeches. There was a message to Israel that this will not stop him. He will continue to attack the Israeli northern border until there's a ceasefire in Gaza, and as long as the Israeli army in Gaza, so he will continue. This is what he promised. Second, domestically, of course, most of the Lebanese people are quite nervous about the possibility of war, and they're not happy with what Hezbollah is doing and that he's dragging Lebanon to war. So he had to justify what he was doing and saying to the wider Lebanese audience that, you know, we are all together in this, and this was an Israeli aggression, and this is something we have to fight together, and so on. And there was another message to the international community accusing Israel in a war crime, talking about the civilian death. Basically, he did not commit himself. He did not declare war. So it gave him some room to maneuver. On the other hand, he said that Israel crossed every red line, which means this is very serious. And of course, at some point, there will be some action that will make the Israeli pay for what they did.
Eitan Shamir in Israel. This is NewsHour. Coming up, we hear how Russian interference in the US elections was focused on Joe Biden running for president.
It's really thrown the Russians so far off their game. They had focused everything really on President Biden. Had, going back to 2018-19, they had really focused on Biden as somebody they needed to remove from office to get what they wanted in Ukraine. Today, that has changed almost entirely.
The headlines: Israel says it struck dozens of Hezbollah sites in Lebanon in an intensifying bombing campaign as it focuses its military's attention northwards. The militant group's leader says the deadly synchronized explosions of its devices crossed all red lines. And one of the top health officials in Africa says the continent is struggling to cope with the spread of the Mpox virus. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. Children in Sweden are going to have to start school a year earlier in an overhaul of an education system that famously favoured play over formal learning in the early stages. The centre-right government has announced the plans, which mean traditional classes will start at 6 years old, not seven, from 2028. Ingrid Pramling Samuelsson is a senior professor of education at the University of Gothenburg. I asked her what she made of the government's plan.
I think it's bad because I think it's based on the number of incorrect assumptions. They think that children develop better if they are taught in a classical school tradition than if they are allowed to play. And that children who play do not learn anything, but they do. And children only learn when they, in classical school tradition, are taught. And I think there's a mixture in the minister's idea about teaching and learning. They think the more teachers teach, the more will children learn. But there's no correlation between what teaching and children's learning, because it's two different things. Children in that age need much more of variety and focus on many more different content area than reading, writing, and mathematics. They need to learn about the social aspect. They need to learn about the nature. They need to develop a lot of different skills in trust in themselves and self-confidence. And that is what happens when children have more possibility of play. I'm not saying that children should play by themselves, but teachers should be responsive to children's play.
Well, it's not as if starting formal education earlier was untested. Almost everybody else in the world does it. Did Swedish children have a problem?
No. But I mean, on the other hand, Swedish preschool teachers, I mean, in this kind of proposal, the values, the competence of an entire profession, the preschool teachers, they have worked for 150 years with the 6 years old and do it very well. And in this idea, they've become an authorized to work with children. Primary school teacher who's going to work with the 6 years old, they do not have to learn anything about children's play. But the preschool teachers have to have a long further education to be able to work with the 6 years old they have done forever.
There must be a stage in Swedish education at the moment where, say, 7, 8, 9 year olds are not as good at reading and writing as children of the same age in other countries. Is that a problem?
Of course it's a problem if they cannot read and write. But, I mean, I think it's just the kind of, they want to do something, because there is a lot of problem when they have these big tests with PISA and so on, and Sweden is not as good as they have been before, but we have a totally other population than we had 20 years ago in Sweden. And then they always blame the one coming before, or the youngest children.
What exactly is structured play? Just describe how it constitutes learning.
I'm saying play where the teacher is responsible. Teachers could be part of children's play. That kind of attitude to be playful with children all the time. In a traditional school setting, I mean, there may be 20, 25 children sitting in benches doing certain things over and over again. And I mean, they're saying that this should be done for it should be more equal. The whole idea is that children should have an equal start. But I think it would go totally the other side, the other way around, that the children coming from more problematic areas, they will drop out because they need more time. I mean, children can learn to read and write, but they can do that in a playful way. They don't have to do it like it's in school, that everybody do the same.
There's been a lot of discussion globally about so-called Swedish-style parenting, a suggestion that Swedish children grew into underdeveloped adults, that they weren't tough enough. Has this played into this discussion?
Swedish students are quite good in many other things when you compare. They, for example, are very good in democracy and in creativity and things like that, even if they are not on top on reading or writing.
Senior Professor of Pedagogy at the University of Gothenburg, Ingrid Pramling Samuelsson. flood defences in Poland's third biggest city, Wrocław, look to have held firm today after the worst floods in at least two decades hit central Europe this week, killing at least 23 people. The flood wave that's inundated the Polish-Czech border since the weekend reached the city of more than 600,000 overnight. The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, travelled to Wrocław today. She met the prime ministers of Poland, Austria, Slovakia and the Czech Republic to discuss EU support. This is what she announced afterwards.
These are extraordinary times, and extraordinary times need extraordinary measures. At first sight, 10 billion euros are possible to mobilize from the cohesion funds for the countries that are affected. This is an emergency reaction now.
Earlier, I spoke to Somini Sengupta, the international climate reporter for the New York Times, and I asked her what conclusions she drew from the announcement by Ursula von der Leyen today.
Two things. One, it's an acknowledgement that even countries in Europe are having to urgently adapt to the hazards of extreme weather. And two, I'm struck by how much in emergency funding the European Union can mobilize. $10 billion is quite a lot of money. And it's not the kind of money that many low and middle income countries have when they face similar or far worse climate hazards.
What's the best way of spending that money, do you think?
Well, I can certainly tell you about the research that I have seen. There are many ways to adapt to what is becoming more frequent and more unpredictable extreme weather events. So for something like storms and flooding, there are a few things that are known to work. One is putting in place an early warning system that very clearly tells people what the weather projections are and advises them on what to do, including, you know, how to get to the closest shelters. That, of course, means having shelters around. There are other things that have worked. For example, giving people cash in advance in order to move themselves out of harm's way. This is particularly critical in low-income countries. In the long term, slightly harder things to do, things like prevent development in flood-prone areas or especially risky areas.
But where those areas are already developed, you'd have to pay people quite a lot of money to move permanently away from riverbanks, wouldn't you?
Well, and that's true, and that may not be necessary in instances like this. So in instances like this, it may well be necessary to shore up physical infrastructures, to make roads and bridges more capable of handling extreme rainfall. But we also know from other examples around the world, examples of extreme flooding, that the damages and the loss of life is really extreme when people are living in particularly risky areas.
We've only got a few seconds, but are you clear there is a connection between these floods and climate change, very briefly?
There is no direct connection between these floods being attributable to climate change. Those studies simply haven't been done yet. However, a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, which means that more extreme rainfall events are a hallmark of climate change.
Somini Sengupta, the international climate reporter for the New York Times, BBC World Service. This is NewsHour.
It used to be seen as a costly and risky challenge, but sustainability has now become a business imperative.
Not having the data is no longer an excuse.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our second episode is all about moving from intention to action on sustainability. Episode 2 of Resilient Edge is coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. The head of the Microsoft Threat Analysis Center has told the BBC that Russia, Iran, and China all have plans to disrupt the US election. BBC Verify's AI correspondent Mark Chislak was given exclusive access to the centre in New York.
Thousands of people, bumper-to-bumper traffic. This is one of the busiest tourist spots in the world, Times Square in New York City. It's the unlikely location of a highly secure facility which is monitoring foreign governments' attempts to destabilise democracy. But that's precisely what's going on in an office building on the far side of the square. Sea of calm, away from the tourists and traffic, this is where we find MTAC, the Microsoft Threat Analysis Center.
Let's take a look now at an actor, or former employees of the Russian Ministry of Defense.
Here, specialist analysts, many with military intelligence backgrounds, detect and disrupt cyber-enabled influence threats to democracies worldwide. Reports they compile advise governments like the UK and US about these risks.
Individuals from this organization serve on a special presidential committee.
Former FBI special agent and now head of MTAC, Clint Watts, tells me Russian-aligned plans to interfere with the US election have been thrown into disarray by Kamala Harris's run for president.
The biggest impact of the switch of President Biden for Vice President Harris has been it's really thrown the Russians so far off their game. They had focused everything really on President Biden. Had going back to 2018-19, they really focused on Biden as somebody they needed to remove from office to get what they wanted in Ukraine. Today, that has changed almost entirely.
Watts goes on to tell me Russian groups aren't the only ones engaging in this kind of activity.
Iran has just entered the fold in recent months, using both cyber attacks and influence operations to try and cause chaos. Then China, in previous cycles, we saw almost nothing from China. But in this case, we do see them establishing social media accounts and websites, which they use to provoke some sort of conversations with American voters. And this is the first cycle where we've had all three that we can definitely point to.
Sana Sakari is an MTAC threat analyst. She tells me that AI is being used in influence campaigns, but in a much more mundane way than many might expect.
We found that in the source code for these websites, they were doing was using AI to rewrite content from a real place and using that for the bulk of their website. And then occasionally they would write real articles when it was a very specific political point they were trying to make.
The US Department of Justice has separately accused Russia and Iran of election interference, recently seizing 32 websites, it says, used AI to try and spread Russian disinformation. With 7 weeks to go, cybersecurity companies and intelligence agencies remain on high alert to online attempts to interfere with an election that has global consequences.
The BBC's Mark Chislak with that report. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. What will be the next move of the Lebanese armed militant group Hezbollah in its ongoing conflict with its arch enemy Israel? Israelis in the north of the country have already been forced to get out of their homes because of the many attacks by Hezbollah missiles from across the border. One of those who stayed is Ariel Frisch, a school principal in the northern Israeli town of Kiryat Shemona. Earlier today, we asked him if he thought a wider war between Israel and Hezbollah was now inevitable.
This is really frightening, this possibility. But on the other hand, I think there is no other possibility. We need to remember that after the 2006 war, there was UN resolution that was about keeping the ceasefire at the north and let us feel secure and prosper and live peacefully. And this was our situation until the 7th of October. And in the 8th of October, when Lebanon attacked Israel, we discovered that Hezbollah used this time to rebuild his army. And we understand that if we let Hezbollah to get only a ceasefire or whatever, it's only a matter of time before the massacre of the 7th of October will happen in the north.
Hezbollah's famous support from Iran manifestly failed to protect it from one of the biggest blows it's ever suffered in the form of the pager and walkie-talkie explosions of the past 48 hours. I've been speaking to Hanin Ghada, who is a Lebanese national. She's senior fellow at the Washington Institute in the US.
This is the biggest humiliation for Hezbollah, and you can see it on the face of its leaders, Hassan Nasrallah, during his speech earlier today. It's a defeat. They've never suffered any kind of defeat. He's the first, for the first time, he actually acknowledged that this is a big blow, and he acknowledged Israel's technological advancement. And he did not really promise any response. This is the first time we see him like this. So it's a huge humiliation. And they have many challenges that they have to figure out before continuing and moving to the next phase of this conflict.
Not least how they communicate, because they can't use pagers or walkie-talkies. What are they going to do?
I don't think they know. The only thing they have today is the cell phones, which they have dropped few months ago when they realized that it has been penetrated by the Israeli intelligence. So they do not trust technology. They know that Israel has more. they have penetrated probably most of their technological military, like if we're talking about communication now, but who knows, maybe they have also penetrated their military, the precision missiles, the technological advancements that they have been bragging about. They don't know how much they have been exposed. They knew that they were exposed, but they had no idea that it really is that deep. They're still figuring out. They have to count their losses. They have to figure out how to communicate. They have to figure out also the level of Israeli penetration. And they have to rebuild the trust with each other and their own community. They're infiltrated, not just technologically, they're infiltrated personally. They have, Israel has many spies among their ranks. And they have lost a lot of high-ranked people in this conflict, especially in the past 2 days.
In the past, Middle Eastern terror groups have opted for ever more low-tech means of communication to get around technological superiority on the part of their enemies. Could Hezbollah go in that direction? What might it look like? Written messages, semaphore, pigeons? I don't know.
Yeah, they have a serious problem with this. They have a challenge they need to figure out. But that's what they did before. Yeah, that's why they stopped using their cell phones and opted for more primitive means of communications, which is the pagers and the talkie-walkies. And the problem, they can't do what Hamas is doing today in Gaza. The Sinwar and his people under the tunnels, they use verbal communications now. They don't use any kind of communications besides verbal communications or like written messages on paper. But Hezbollah cannot do that, because Hezbollah is not just limited to a certain area in Lebanon where they can reach each other very quickly. They are all over Lebanon. They are all over the region. They cannot just reach each other whenever they want. They cannot do what Hamas is doing. They need to figure out something between, verbal and the talkie-walkie. But the problem is that they cannot trust it. The only option they have today is wait until, see what they can do, maybe order from a more secure source, and it's going to take some time. Or they have to risk it. They have to go back to cell phones and risk more casualties and risk more intelligence exposure to Israelis intelligence, which is not something that they want to do.
In the end, what's your assessment? Does what's happened in the past 48 hours make it more or less likely that Hezbollah could go to war with Israel?
Hezbollah definitely will not go to war with Israel. Today, it's very obvious with Nasrallah's statements that they are not doing that. He said it very clearly that they are going to continue with what they're doing. They're going to continue threatening the north of Israel because they see this as the main achievement, that is moving the buffer zone, the security zone from south of Lebanon to north Israel. And they're not going to let this go, especially after all these sacrifices. That's what he said, like the pain and the sacrifices are not going to go for nothing. We're going to go continue this threat. The only reason, the only way, the only diplomatic solution to stop it is a ceasefire in Gaza. However, the decision of war is not really in Hezbollah's hands or in Iran's hands. The decision of war is an Israeli decision.
Could what's happened even spell the beginning of the end for Hezbollah?
I don't think this is the end of Hezbollah. This is a big blow for Hezbollah. This is a real defeat for Hezbollah in the sense that it set them back. But to eliminate Hezbollah is not a war against Hezbollah. It's not even more strikes against Hezbollah. You cannot eliminate Hezbollah like that. You can weaken Hezbollah. You can contain them. But the Hezbollah is not just in Lebanon. Hezbollah is all over the region. Hezbollah is not a proxy of Iran the way the others are proxies of Iran. Hezbollah is part of the Iran Revolutionary Guards Corps. It's part of its Quds force. They are part of the decision making. They are part of the institution. So to eliminate Hezbollah, you have to answer the Iran question, whether, you know, like if Iran continues to support Hezbollah and the borders between Iran and Lebanon, including Iraq and Syria, continues to be open for all the smuggling of weapons and transportation of soldiers, then Hezbollah cannot be eliminated. It will only be weakened. You have to cut the supply routes. You have to answer the question of sovereignty of these states and the decisions of making of war and peace. And you have to answer the question of Iran's, like, what to do with Iran's regional operations, what to do with Iran's regional empire. That's the question that would lead to either really transforming Hezbollah into a political movement or eliminating Hezbollah, because it's an Iran decision at the end of the day.
That was Hanin Ghadar in Washington. Now, the BBC has revealed that the late Mohammed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, has been accused of rape by five female former employees. Al-Fayed, the Egyptian-born businessman, rose from a poor family in Alexandria to buying the world-famous department store in 1985. A BBC documentary has uncovered evidence that under Mohammed Al-Fayed's ownership, Harrods not only failed to intervene but helped to cover up abuse allegations. This report from Shaima Khalil contains descriptions of sexual violence.
Yeah, I went back to Harrods about a year ago. I knew if I could walk through and come out the other side, I'd be in a good place to be talking to you.
I joined Harrods because I wanted to be a buyer, and I ended up working for an absolute monster.
When Mohammed Al-Fayed took over Harrods, the world-famous department store, he quickly embraced his high-profile role and the status that came with it. To his customers and the celebrity guests, he was all charm. But to many of his female employees, he was a different man, a predator. We've heard testimony from more than 20 of Al-Fayed's female ex-employees.
He tried to rape me more than once.
And he pushed me in and onto the bed so that I couldn't move.
You know, he was 79, nearly 80, and I was 15.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was rich and powerful. That power allowed him to carry out assault at scale over decades.
I was in France and he had come upstairs into my room. I was absolutely terrified.
Sophia worked as his personal assistant for 3 years, starting in 1988.
Got into bed with me, was trying to kiss me and push himself on me. And I just kicked him off. I kicked him, kicked him, kicked him, kicked him, screamed. And again, I've got him off. I was just terrified.
We also spoke to Gemma, who worked as Al-Fayed's personal assistant for 2 years in the late 2000s.
I think Mohammed Al-Fayed is a rapist. I think he's a serial rapist.
I joined in 2007 and it was my first job in London. His behaviour was become more scary while I was on the trips. My first trip was actually to Abu Dhabi and he was trying to get in my room in quite an aggressive manner. It was absolutely terrifying. Just didn't know which way to turn. So I bought a small dictaphone that I had in my pocket, and these are the transcripts from those recordings. One of them was in Paris in his residence there, Villa Windsor. I said, I'll just want to go to sleep on my own. Mr. Fayed, I don't want to. Mr. Fayed. And he kept saying, relax, please relax. Like, how can you relax when you're in that situation? He walked out and he was angry.
Not long after this incident, Gemma says Al-Fayed raped her. The BBC has heard testimony from four other women who say he raped them at his properties. In 2009, Gemma contacted a lawyer who told Harrods she was leaving her job on the grounds of sexual harassment. She didn't feel able to disclose the more serious allegations at the time. They agreed to pay a settlement if she signed a non-disclosure agreement. There was also one other condition.
The lawyers organised for a shredding truck to come to my lawyer's office.
where we placed everything in. It was shredded in front of us, including tapes I had of him, my phone that had messages and voicemails, really quite nasty voicemails on them.
Someone from HR was present for the shredding of all of the evidence I had.
I thought I'd lost the transcripts, but actually what I did have was the transcriptions sent to my lawyer in my sent items of my email account at the time.
In a statement, the current owners of Harrods say they were utterly appalled by the allegations and that employees who are his victims had been failed, for which they sincerely apologized. They also said that the Harrods of today is a very different organization to the one owned and controlled by Al-Fayed between 1985 and 2010. There were several attempts to expose Al-Fayed before his death, but it is only now that many of the survivors feel able to speak publicly about the abuse. For those who have, the silence and the taboo are finally broken.
And since the BBC reported this story, Harrods has said that it has a process available to women who say they were attacked by Fayed, adding, "It's been our priority to settle claims in the quickest way possible, avoiding lengthy legal proceedings," it says, "for the women involved." You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour live from the BBC. The US Special Envoy for Afghan Women and Girls has admitted that extensive face-to-face negotiations with the Taliban have failed to stem a dramatic erosion of female rights in Afghanistan. Rina Amiri has had a series of talks with the Taliban, the latest this summer, which were swiftly followed by a new law banning women from speaking outside their homes. Since the sudden withdrawal of Western troops from Afghanistan in 2021, promises to respect human rights have been broken by the Taliban, who returned to power, reimposing public executions, amputations, and a ban on education for girls once they reach the age of 12. Rina Amiri spoke to me earlier. To what extent had she been pressing the Taliban to allow girls back to school?
Yes, I've met with the Taliban repeatedly since my appointment in January 2022. I and my colleagues have consistently appealed to the Taliban, not just to return girls to school, but to respect the rights of the Afghan population, for girls to be back in school, for women to have the right to work. And it's not just limited to women and girls. Men are affected by it. Ethnic and religious communities feel increasingly vulnerable and targeted. It is the country as a whole that is suffering from the extraordinary restrictions that the Taliban are placing on the Afghan people.
And when you say to Afghan representatives, you need to change this, you need to change that, what do they say?
You know, what is interesting is the Taliban's rhetoric has changed, and it's a change that we should pay attention to. When I first started this conversation with the Taliban, I specifically mentioned the rights of women and girls to education, and they said, we are going to return girls to school, not because of what you, the international community, ask, but it is because it is our own obligation. It is something enshrined in Islam. That is the argument that they made. That tone has shifted. Now they call it an internal issue. Now they defend it on the basis of culture. They have become increasingly emboldened. In fact, what they're signaling is that there are going to be more extreme measures and that they are determined to implement these extreme measures, particularly this morality, so-called morality law, the vice and virtue law, is extremely alarming, because what they are making very clear is that there will be more to come. So this is something that the international community, I think, has to recognize.
But everyone does recognize it, because it's blindingly obvious, and all your contact with the Taliban and all the pleas and the pressure from the West isn't just not working, it's having the opposite effect.
There are some who still make the argument that if you just provide more assistance to the Taliban, if you really lean in and do more in terms of removing sanctions, that the Taliban are going to adopt a different set of policies. And I don't see anything in the Taliban's rhetoric that would suggest that that is a scenario that they're interested in.
What does work then? What is the line? What is the pressure if talks have yielded precisely nothing?
I think our policies have to not only look at the Taliban, but the Afghan population. Our messaging, our efforts, our concrete initiatives have to be focused on both supporting the Afghan population, particularly women and girls, as well as continuing to make the case to the Taliban that the approach that they're taking is only going to take the country backwards and is going to make them lose legitimacy, not just with us, but with the Afghan population.
What's it like in the room as a woman negotiating face-to-face with Taliban representatives? How do they treat you?
They're very savvy actors. They treat me with courtesy and respect because they see me not just as a woman, but as a representative of the U.S. If they treated Afghan women the way that they treat women leaders from around the world, I think we would have a vastly different situation.
That was the U.S. Special Envoy for Afghan Women and Girls, Rina Amiri. Now, it used to take a tower of bookshelves to store the 3 billion codes that make up our human genome. Now, scientists from Southampton University in the south of England say they've stored the full genome on what's apparently called a 5D memory crystal, and it's been put in the Memory of Mankind archive in a salt cave in Austria. Professor Sarah Teichman is a geneticist at the University of Cambridge. My colleague Tim Franks asked her what she made of this technological feat.
We have 3 billion letters in our genetic code. So getting each of those letters, you know, correct in the right order and actually fitting them onto a crystal is obviously a huge feat. And I take my hat off to the team at Southampton University.
And I know that you're a geneticist rather than a material scientist, but do you know what a 5D memory crystal is?
At a high level, it's a very stable quartz, and the 5D, as I understand it, comes from the fact that they're able to encode things sort of in two orthogonal layers or dimensions that can be read out when light is shone kind of in two different directions, as it were.
I mean, this is essentially the basic coding information on how a human being is constructed. Is that a reasonable way of looking at it?
That's correct. So the human genome has about 25 to 30,000 genes. Our genome consists of about 3 billion base pairs, which are the four letters, A, C, T, and G, that make up our genes in a triplet code. About 1% of our genome codes for these genes, and they're expressed, they're switched on in different combinations in the different cells in our body. We know that an adult body consists of about 37 trillion cells. And in the Human Cell Atlas project that I co-founded and co-chair, we're using single cell and spatial genomics technologies to actually map all the different cell types in our tissues and our organs. And so that's kind of the scale of the complexity of the genetic code.
Part of the interest in this story is not just that the fact that it has been encoded onto this tiny thing that can withstand great heat and last for billions of years, but it's this idea that it's a sort of, it's a blueprint should our species ever be wiped out. I mean, it feels sort of rather distant and rather doomy.
It is sobering, yeah. Yeah, but you're right. The idea is that our genetic code does, in fact, encode the instruction manual for how to build a human. And of course, the way we are built kind of naturally is it's a single cell that we all start from at the very beginning of pregnancy. And then 9 months later, you have a tiny human. And then that matures into the adults like you and me. And so it's that sort of complexity of cellular development and cellular composition that we're mapping.
Sarah Teichman there from Cambridge University. That was NewsHour. Thanks for listening to this edition. Do come back soon. Enjoy what's left of your day. Bye for now.
In the face of unprecedented disruption, it's become non-negotiable.
Companies are moving to what they call anti-fragile status.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC StoryWorks Commercial Productions.
Our third episode is about supply chain resiliency and what it takes for organizations to minimize their risk and improve efficiency. So watch out for episode 3 of Resilient Edge, coming soon wherever you get your podcasts.